Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are really getting into someone whose face, whose voice, well, you probably recognize them instantly.
Absolutely. But maybe you don't know the full story, the kind of strategic thinking behind the career.
Exactly. We're pulling back the curtain on Robert Scott Adsit.
Yeah, Scott Adsit. And this is perfect for you, our Deep Dive learners, because his career, it's like a masterclass in versatility. Just think about the range.
It's huge.
Yeah.
From that, you know, perfectly stressed out producer Pete Hornberger on 30 Rock.
Right, to maybe the most compassionate robot ever, Baymax in Big Hero 6.
So our mission today is really to understand how he built that. How do you connect, say, biting Chicago satire with, well, huggable Disney robots? What were the pivots? The choices.
And we've got a great source biography to work from here. It covers his start, those really key roles, the collaborations. It's all in there.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. He was born Robert Scott Adsit, November 26, 1965, Northbrook, Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Pretty standard middle American start, you could say. His parents were Genevieve, or Jenny, and Andrew Scott Adsit, who was a real estate attorney.
So a solid background, but not necessarily one that screams future voice of global therapeutic care.
Right. Ha, no, not exactly. But that contrast, that interesting journey, it kind of starts early on.
Okay.
Like a lot of comedians, he was apparently the class clown back at Glenbrook North High School.
Makes sense.
But the thing that really launched him professionally, it seems, was a bit of restlessness. He went off to DePaul University in Indiana.
Right.
Stayed for like one semester. That's it.
Wow. Okay. So quick realization that wasn't the path.
Yeah, pretty much. And that led him to Columbia College, Chicago. And that, well, that decision seems to have changed everything.
Right. Let's unpack that Chicago move, because Columbia College Chicago,
yeah,
that puts him right in the orbit of some pretty legendary figures. Yeah,
exactly. Specifically, an acting teacher named Sheldon Patinkin. You hear his name mentioned a lot as someone who just cultivated generations of Chicago talent.
And Patinkin saw something in Adsit.
Apparently so. Not just, you know, raw, funny talent, but maybe that discipline needed for really high-level improv, that structure beneath the chaos.
Okay.
So Patinkin basically told him, you need to join the Second City, gave him his marching orders.
And he listened.
He did. Joined Second City in 87. But the real step up, the big leagues within Second City, was getting on to the main stage cast in 1994.
And that's not just like getting a part in a play. Being on the Second City main stage, that's different.
Oh, totally. It's like entering the absolute crucible where modern American sketch comedy was and still is forged. It's legendary.
And he wasn't just there. He succeeded pretty quickly, too.
Yeah, immediate impact. He was part of these Joseph Jefferson Award-winning reviews. You know, the Jeff Awards are Chicago's big theater awards.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Pinata Full of Bees, and then the really celebrated one, Paradigm Lost. And for Paradigm Lost, he actually won the Jeff Award for Best Actor in a Comedy.
Okay, so for listeners maybe not steeped in Chicago theater history,
yeah,
how significant is winning a Jeff for a Second City show?
It's huge. It's kind of like winning a major award for something everyone knows is brilliant, but also collaborative. It means you stood out. You weren't just funny. You were a key part of this acclaimed, really tightly constructed thing.
Especially considering who he was working with.
Exactly. Think about the names on that stage with him. Tina Fey, Kevin Dorff, Rachel Dratch, Adam McKay. I mean, these are people who basically went on to build the next couple of decades of TV comedy.
Right. Future SNL head writers. Stars.
So winning Best Actor in that company, that just shows incredible mastery of the form. You're holding your own with giants.
And there's a specific sketch from that time that gets mentioned a lot, right? Gump.
Yes, Gump. He did that with Adam McKay, and it was apparently so good, so iconic for them, that Second City actually included it in their official Best Of compilation.
Wow. So even back then, that collaborative spark, particularly with McKay, was obvious.
Absolutely. And we actually have like visual proof of this whole era. There was a PBS documentary in 1997 called Second to None.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it followed the creation of Paradigm Lost, the whole intense, probably grueling process. And you see Adsit right there working alongside Fay, Dratch, Dorff.
So it really cements him. He wasn't just around. He was a core figure in that specific, incredibly fertile generation of Second City talent.
Totally. But here's where it gets really interesting for understanding his range. Even while he's doing this top tier satire, he's also doing other work to, you know, pay the bills.
Right. The actor's life.
And the range is kind of staggering. Stuff that's wildly different. And one project that was, well, deeply serious.
Okay, let's start there. The serious one sounds like a real contrast.
It really is. In 1996, he did this short film. It was for the Hazelden Substance Abuse Clinic. It's called Reflections from the Heart of a Child.
And he wasn't doing comedy in it.
No, not at all. He played an alcoholic and drug-addicted father, a serious, dramatic role.
And this wasn't just some obscure PSA, was it?
No, apparently not. Our sources say this short film actually became required viewing. Like, part of the curriculum in most DWI repeat offender classes across the U.S. and in substance abuse rehab clinics, too.
Whoa. Okay, stop and think about that for a second. Here's Scott Adsit. One night you're on stage at Second City getting huge laughs, satirizing, I don't know, politics or whatever.
Right.
And the next day you're embodying this tragic figure, this addict father, for a film that's going to be shown to thousands of people in recovery or facing judges.
The mental leap required there is just incredible. It demands this immediate grounding in, like, real human empathy, serious drama.
It proves his toolkit was way bigger than just sketch comedy, even back then.
Absolutely. That improv training, which is all about immediate behavioral understanding, emotional commitment, it clearly translated directly to serious drama. It wasn't just a side gig. It had real social impact.
Okay, so from required viewing for addiction recovery, where does the pendulum swing next?
To maybe the most wonderfully absurd place possible, pinball machines.
Ah, yes, the pinball wizard credit. I saw that.
1997. He did voices for the Williams pinball machine Medieval Madness, which, by the way, is still considered, like, an all-time classic by pinball fanatics.
And what roles did he voice? It wasn't just one, was it?
No, he was several characters. The King of Pain, Sir Psycho, the Duke of Bourbon, and Merlin.
I just love picturing the Jeff Award-winning actor fresh off playing a tragic addict in a booth somewhere yelling, "I am the King of Pain."
Right. But here's the kicker. The really cool Second City connection. He didn't just voice it. He actually co-wrote the dialogue, the lines for the game.
No way.
Yeah. With Kevin Dorff, another Second City guy who was also in Paradigm Lost.
So they were bringing that specific Chicago comedy writing sensibility to a pinball game.
Exactly. It just shows that whole ecosystem. These performers, they weren't just actors waiting for scripts. They were writers, creators, directors, applying their skills to everything. Award-winning reviews, serious PSAs, and yeah, coin-op entertainment.
Constant hustle, constant creation, using every medium they could find.
Pretty much. That seems to be the Chicago way.
Okay, so all that success, that recognition in Chicago, naturally, the next step is off in Hollywood, right?
Yeah, seems like it. He moved out to Los Angeles in 1998. And the initial reason, the hook, was actually another old connection.
Who was that?
His college friend, Dino Stamatopoulos. Remember him? They worked together later on Moral Oral.
Right, right.
Dino invited him out to L.A. to work on a sketch comedy pilot he was doing.
Ah, okay. A familiar world.
Yeah. Now, the pilot itself apparently never actually materialized, didn't get picked up.
Happens all the time.
But the move stuck. Adsit stayed in L.A., and he started getting work pretty much straight away. Commercials, bit parts, you know, the drill.
But he found his footing pretty quickly in that sort of alt comedy scene that was bubbling up then.
Totally. He landed some roles that gave him serious cred almost immediately. Like, he was in 6 episodes of Mr. Show with Bob and David.
Which was huge. Groundbreaking stuff, playing various roles.
Yeah, different characters, showed he could slot right into that really specific, high-concept, absurd style they had.
And he seemed to have this knack for playing the straight man against the chaos.
Definitely. You see that really clearly in his recurring gig on the Tenacious D HBO show.
Oh, yeah. He was their neighbor, right?
He was their neighbor, who also happened to be often a demon.
Huh. Perfect. That's such a great encapsulation. The mundane, slightly put upon neighbor, who's also a literal demon. It's that grounding reality mixed with total absurdity.
He nails that. He's the perfect foil. He keeps the scene somehow anchored while accepting the absolute madness around him.
And that pattern kind of continued with other guest spots, right? Recognizable ones.
Yeah, he popped up in Friends in 2002. Remember Ross and Monica's cousin, Cassie? He was in that episode.
Vaguely, yeah.
And he had a really memorable bit as a photographer in the Office episode, Conflict Resolution, the one where Michael posts everyone's complaints. Adsit's the slightly harassed photographer trying to get a group shot.
Right. He's the guy who comes in, does his job perfectly, makes the main character seem even funnier or weirder by comparison, and then leaves. Solid character work.
Exactly. He was building this really solid foundation, respected guy, does good work, but maybe still waiting for that one defining, long-running role.
Which brings us to 2005. And this is the moment, the pivotal choice that you mentioned earlier. This really shaped the next decade of TV comedy, didn't it?
It absolutely did.
Yeah.
And it all comes down to loyalty and maybe trusting your gut, trusting your history with someone.
Okay, set the scene. How did it unfold?
So he gets a phone call. It's from Tina Fey, his old Second City castmate.
Right.
And she says, basically, "Hey, I'm writing this new show about a sketch comedy program, and I'm writing a part specifically for you."
Wow. Okay, that's the dream call.
Totally. But at the exact same time, he'd auditioned for another show, Aaron Sorkin's highly, highly anticipated new series, also about the drama behind a TV variety show.
Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
Yeah.
Remember the buzz around that? Sorkin was coming off the West Wing. He was like untouchable.
Exactly. Prestige TV personified the golden boy, as Adsit himself apparently put it.
So Adsit's manager calls him up.
And basically lays it out. High stakes time. Says something like, "Look, you're probably going to get offered both of these. You need to tell me right now, which one do you want?"
Oh, man. Talk about pressure. Because the industry wisdom, everyone, would have said Sorkin, right?
Overwhelmingly, that was the safe bet, the guaranteed prestige project from the guy who just finished one of the most acclaimed dramas ever.
And Tina Fey, at that point, she was known for SNL, especially Weekend Update, but maybe seen as, I don't know, edgier? Riskier as a showrunner for a primetime sitcom?
That seems to be how Adsit saw the comparison. He described Fey as the lady from Weekend Update that riles a lot of people. So Sorkin, the golden boy, versus Fey, the known quantity, the respected collaborator, but maybe the less obvious career move at that exact moment.
So what did you do?
The choice.
He chose Faye. His reasoning was apparently pretty simple and direct. I had to go with somebody I know and respect. I went with Tina.
Wow, that speaks volumes, doesn't it? Trusting the relationship, the creative chemistry forged back in Chicago over the perceived sure thing. It's an incredible lesson in navigating a career. And I mean, look how it played out. 30 Rock became this massive, critical, and cult hit, ran for 7 seasons, redefined comedy,
And Studio 60.
canceled after one season, didn't really land.
So by prioritizing that friendship, that known creative partnership, Adsit basically secured his place in TV history.
You could definitely argue that. It was a huge bet on a person, and it paid off spectacularly.
Okay, so that decision lands in the role of Pete Hornberger on 30 Rock. We'll definitely get more into Pete in a bit. But here's another layer of complexity to his career at this time.
Right. Because while he's doing 30 Rock, this relatively mainstream Emmy-winning network sitcom.
He's simultaneously deep into something completely different, like wildly different, in the world of stop-motion animation.
Yeah, thanks again to that connection with Dino Stamatopoulos. This is where you really see the depth of Adsit's contribution beyond just acting.
Their first big collaboration after the LA move was Moral Oral, right? On Adult Swim.
That's the one. Ran from 2005 to 2008. And Adsit wasn't just like a voice on the show. He was core creative. He co-directed, co-wrote, and co-produced the entire thing with Stamatopoulos and Jay Johnston.
And Moral Oral? I mean, if you've seen it, you know,
Yeah.
it looks kind of like those old innocent claymation shows like Davy and Goliath.
Yeah, that's the surface look. But
Yeah.
underneath, oh man, it is brutal.
Brutal is the right word. It's this incredibly dark, cutting satire about religious hypocrisy, suburban dysfunction, broken families,
Yeah.
all hiding behind this kid's show veneer.
It's genuinely unsettling stuff, really pushing the boundaries of satire, especially for animation back then.
And Adsit's main voice role in this incredibly dark show was Clay Puffington, Roll's dad.
Well, Clay Puffington, and his performance as Clay is just masterful in its unpleasantness. He got nominated for an Annie Award for it, which is animation's big award.
What's the voice like? How does he capture that character?
It's all about suppressed rage and disappointment, I think. Clay's voice is kind of nasal, very stiff. He's always drunk, deeply unhappy, emotionally abusive. Adsit gives him this cadence, this vocal texture that just perfectly embodies like toxic masculinity masking complete brokenness, emotional constipation, maybe.
Right. That tightly wound, almost whining quality sometimes, it's so specific and so different from, say, Pete Hornberger's kind of weary anxiety.
Worlds apart. And think about the workload on that show for him. He's writing, directing, producing, and voicing the main antagonist, basically. But not just Clay.
You did other voices too.
Oh, yeah, a whole bunch of them. The list is kind of staggering. Doughy, Link McMissen's the school counselor, Art Poza Buell, Dr. Potter's Wheel, Billy Figurelli, a load of secondary characters.
So in a single episode, he might be voicing, what, 10 different characters?
Oh.
While also having directed and written it.
Pretty much. It requires this incredible vocal agility. You have to switch between these distinct voices, often really quickly. Right.
Which sounds like, well, it sounds like Second City improv training again, doesn't it? Creating distinct characters on the fly.
Exactly. It's that same muscle. Yeah. Generating a new character, voice, emotional center, boom, instantly. He just applied that engine to the very demanding, meticulous world of stop-motion animation.
And that collaboration with Stamatopoulos, that dark stop-motion engine,
yeah,
it didn't stop with Moral Oral, did it?
Nope. After Moral Oral finished its run, they teamed up again pretty quickly for Mary Shelley's Frankenhole.
Right. Another Adult Swim stop-motion show.
Yeah.
Ran 2010 to 2012, I think.
Yeah, two seasons, 20 episodes. And again, just bizarre, macabre, funny. It mashed up historical figures and monsters in this weird laboratory setting.
Yeah, and Edsett's role was similar, behind the scenes and voicing.
Yep, same deal. Directing, writing, producing, and voicing key characters again. Professor Polidori, the creature, Dr. Moreau.
Okay, classic horror figure.
But also Thomas Jefferson. And maybe most provocatively, Adolf Hitler.
Wow, okay. Voicing Hitler in a comedy show. That's definitely leaning into the grotesque.
It is. And it really shows, I think, his willingness to go to uncomfortable places for satire. He's not afraid of controversy or darkness if it serves the comedic point, however strange or disturbing that point might be.
So this whole Adult Swim phase, running alongside 30 Rock, it just paints a picture of someone who's actively seeking out stuff that's creatively challenging, maybe a bit weird, definitely demanding.
Yeah, not just taking the easy path. He's juggling network sitcom stardom with auteur-driven, boundary-pushing, cult animation. It's quite the balancing act.
Okay, so let's pivot back now to the roles that probably brought Adsett his widest recognition.
Yeah.
The two roles that, as you said earlier, kind of represent these two fascinating poles of his career.
Exactly. The jaded but relatable realist and the pure embodiment of compassion.
First up, the cornerstone of his live-action success. Pete Hornberger on 30 Rock ran from 2006 to 2013.
Pete, you gotta love Pete. He wasn't just the producer of TGS, the show within the show. He was really the long-suffering conscience of the whole operation, wasn't he?
Yeah, totally. Liz Lemon's oldest friend there, often the voice of reason, or maybe more often just the embodiment of sheer panic and exhaustion in the face of all the network craziness.
He was so essential because he wasn't absurd like Jack Donaghy or Tracy Jordan or Jenna Maroney. He was the normal guy, the everyman, just constantly on the verge of, well, something collapsing.
He perfected playing that terrified but trying his best vibe, that well-meaning competence constantly undermined by the chaos around him.
And that relatability, that grounding he provided was crucial. It allowed the show's other characters to be even more surreal and out there. Pete was the anchor.
And the show itself was just a massive success. Critically adored, tons of awards.
7 seasons, yeah. I think it got something like 103 Emmy nominations over its run. Just huge.
So Edsett shared in that success, obviously, part of that legendary ensemble.
Absolutely. He won a Screen Actors Guild Award, SAG Award, for outstanding performance by an ensemble in a comedy series back in 2008, along with the whole cast.
Which really speaks to how vital he was to that mix. It wasn't just the stars. It was the whole comedic machine working together.
Definitely. He was indispensable to 30 Rock's dynamic.
Okay, now, fast forward just a year after 30 Rock ends, 2014.
Yeah.
And we get maybe the most dramatic shift in his entire career.
Yeah, the leap to Disney Animation, voicing Baymax in Big Hero 6.
It's almost hard to reconcile, isn't it? Going from the tightly wound, nervous energy of Pete Hornberger.
Or the abrasive nasal anger of Clay Puppington in Moral Oral.
Right, to the voice of Baymax. This incredibly gentle, clinical, yet profoundly compassionate, inflatable robot.
The character itself is built on limitations, right? Mm-hmm. Baymax is a healthcare companion. He's programmed for specific tasks, specific phrases. His voice has to be kind of neutral, low inflection almost, robotic.
But that's the magic of Edsett's performance. Within those constraints, he manages to convey such genuine warmth, such gentle empathy. It's extraordinary.
And the filmmakers knew it. The producer, Roy Conley, talked about this specifically. He praised Adsit, saying he was hilarious, but also had this unique ability to, how do you put it, shape the language in a way that makes you feel Baymax's emotion and sense of humor.
Even though he's playing a robot with very limited vocal expression.
Exactly. That's the skill. Conveying deep humanity through deliberate vocal restraint.
Just compare the actual sound.
Yeah.
Baymax's voice is smooth, deep, measured, almost musical in its calm monotone sometimes.
And then think of Clay Puppington's voice. Harsh, nasal, full of tension and bitterness.
It's like two completely different instruments, the vocal dexterity required to do both so convincingly.
Yeah.
It's just incredible.
It really is. It's not just doing voices. It's modulating everything. Pitch, tone, rhythm, emotional underpinning to create these radically different beings. That's real mastery.
And obviously, Baymax was a huge hit. The character became instantly iconic.
Totally. And that performance has given Adsit this incredible longevity with the character. It wasn't just the movie.
No, he's reprised the role so many times. There was Big Hero 6. The series on Disney Channel ran for several years.
Right, 2017 to 2021. Then the Baymax miniseries on Disney Plus in 2022.
He was Baymax again in that recent short film, Once Upon a Studio, celebrating Disney's 100th.
Uh-huh. And the video games, too. Disney Infinity, Kingdom Hearts III. He is the voice of Baymax, period. Indispensable.
But even while he's becoming the voice of Disney compassion, he didn't completely abandon the world of more biting adult satire, did he?
No, not at all. He popped up in HBO's Veep, another critically acclaimed sharp satire.
Who was he in Veep?
He played Greg Hart, who was a news anchor, I believe, kind of embodied that slick, slightly vacuous media personality. He was in 8 episodes between 2015 and 2019.
So that's tapping back into that more anxious corporate, maybe slightly smarmy side we saw hints of in Pete, but tailored for that brutal political environment of Veep.
Exactly. And then swinging back again to the truly bizarre, he showed up in an Adult Swim live-action show called The Heart She Holler.
Oh, wow. That show was something else. Very weird. Southern gothic parody.
Yeah, super strange. Starred Patton Oswalt, Kristen Skoll. Amy Sedaris was in it, too. And Adsit played the corrupt town sheriff.
And apparently he had great chemistry with Amy Sedaris.
This is the critics noted, yeah. Which, again, shows his adaptability. He can go from the high-status, rapid-fire dialogue of Veep to the weird, often improvised, backwoods absurdity of something like The Heart, She Holler, and fit right in.
It all comes back to that improv grounding, doesn't it? Being able to react and play truthfully in any situation, no matter how strange.
Seems like it's the core skill underpinning everything else.
So if we kind of zoom out now and look at the whole picture, all these different threads, What pattern emerges?
Well, one thing that stands out is he's not always chasing the lead role, you know? He seems very strategic about taking these memorable supporting parts, often in really high-profile projects.
The perfect straight man, the character foil.
Exactly. The guy who makes the scene work makes the stars shine brighter. And that keeps him consistently visible across all sorts of genres.
You see that in his film work too, right? Even the smaller roles.
Definitely. Like, he popped up in The Italian Job back in 2003 and The Terminal with Tom Hanks in 2004. Often just playing these functional characters, a cab driver, I think. Someone who has a brief, memorable interaction.
He was the rival coach, Stu, in Will Ferrell's Kicking and Screaming. That was a fun one.
Yeah. And a doctor in We're the Millers?
No.
Little parts, but they add up. They show his reliability, his ability to make a small moment land.
Okay, and then there's something for the real pop culture nerds listening. The ultimate meta reference.
Ah, yes, the Deadpool connection. This is brilliant.
Since 2012, apparently, there's been a recurring character in Marvel's Deadpool comics named Agent Scott Adsit.
A S-H-I-E-L-D agent, no less, who looks like him.
That's just perfect, isn't it? Is this amazing meta nod from the comic world, Acknowledging his place in comedy, linking him to the character who's all about breaking the fourth wall. Mm. It just fits.
Totally. It's like the universe acknowledging his specific brand of comedic presence.
But just when you think he's settled into comedy and voice work, He throws another curveball. He keeps those dramatic muscles working, too.
Right. Like, in 2020, taking on a recurring role in The Walking Dead, World Beyond.
Okay, that's a serious pivot. From 30 Rock and Baymax to the grim, post-apocalyptic world of The Walking Dead.
Plays a character named Tony Delmato. It's a deliberate move back into serious, character-driven drama. Again, proving you just can't pigeonhole him, he refuses to be put in one box.
And another thread that seems really consistent is his connection to the audio world, to podcasting.
Yeah, he seems really comfortable in that space, especially within that sort of Max Fun, John Hodgman extended universe.
He's been the guest bailiff on Hodgman's podcast, Judge John Hodgman, multiple times, right?
Yeah, 3 episodes mentioned in our sources. And he was also in Hodgman's Netflix special, Ragnarok, playing himself. It shows he's still very much part of that collaborative modern comedy scene, working with friends.
Which ties into maybe the most telling thing about his commitment to the craft.
His live improv work.
Exactly. Despite all the success, TV, movies, major animation, he still performs live improv regularly.
Yeah, he has these ongoing duo shows, John and Scott with John Lutz, who was also on 30 Rock.
Lutz, right.
And Adsit and Evelith with Jet Evelith, another amazing improviser.
And he teaches too, right, at places like Iowa West and UCB,
yeah.
Upright Citizens Brigade.
Mm-hmm. And that's key, because teaching and performing live improv, it's not just like a hobby or nostalgia. It's actively keeping those core skills sharp.
The instantaneous creativity, the listening, the collaboration.
All the stuff that made him so good in those fast-paced writer's rooms or recording booths for 30 Rock or Moral Oral. He's constantly honing the instrument.
And he's still working constantly. The output hasn't really slowed down.
No kidding. Recently, he voiced Peer Pressure in the new Megamind animated series and the movie Megamind versus the Doom Syndicate.
Still doing voice work for shows like Teenage Euthanasia. And there's a movie listed as currently filming called What the Fike Is My Password?
Huh. Okay. Sounds intriguing. But yeah, he just seems to operate this incredible pace, suggesting he just genuinely loves the work, loves the process, whatever the medium is.
A true working actor, in the best sense. Hashtag tag outro.
So when you pull it all together, all these pieces we've talked about, what's the big takeaway from this deep dive into Scott Adsit's career?
For me, it really comes down to a couple of things. Loyalty is huge.
Yeah, that Faye decision looms large.
Definitely. Choosing that known relationship, that trusted collaborator, over the maybe more obvious prestige choice, that defines so much. He valued the connection.
And the other thing is that incredible ability to bring humanity, real feeling, to characters who are often defined by constraints.
Right. Whether it's the absurdity surrounding Pete Hornberger, or the literal programming of Baymax, or even the grotesque limitations of Clay Puppington.
He finds the human core in there. Or, in Baymax's case, creates a believable simulation of it that feels just as real. He injects that spectrum of emotion, weary resignation, pure compassion, bitter anger into these really specific frameworks.
He perfected that performance duality.
Absolutely. Thriving in the darkest corners of Adult Swim satire, writing, directing, voicing Clay, even Hitler.
While simultaneously becoming the voice of maybe the kindest, most purely empathetic character in modern Disney animation.
Successfully navigating those two extremes, often within the same few years. That's the signature of his whole career, isn't it?
It really is. And maybe that's the final thought to leave you all with. Just consider the kind of, I don't know, mental and artistic flexibility that requires.
Yeah. To operate at both those poles, from satire so dark it's used in rehab programs, to the most gentle, soothing voice imaginable, designed purely to heal.
Scott Adsit mastered that incredible range.
Hmm.
A true architect of both comedy and, surprisingly, compassion.
A fascinating career, a really phenomenal deep dive. Thanks for joining us to explore the sources on Scott Adsit.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.